court will proceed to the fifth case, United States versus Chapman.
I still have my jacket on.
You're very smart.
Well, we've got to go sleep.
Not today. Mr. Burke. Stephen Burke?
Yes.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Steve Burke with Quarles & Brady from Milwaukee, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the defendant appellant Delbert Chapman. On April 27, 2001, Mr. Chapman was convicted in the Southern District of Illinois of conspiring to distribute in excess of 50 grams of crack cocaine. At his sentencing hearing on February 19, 2002, the court found a relevant conduct drug quantity in slightly in excess of 1,500 grams, and additionally, the court imposed 4 2-level sentencing enhancements. Mr. Chapman's adjusted offense level was 46, leading to a mandatory life sentence. It is this sentencing hearing of which Mr. Chapman today complains.
Now, Mr. Burke, just mathematically, isn't it true that we would have to agree with you on your drug quantity argument and at least one of your enhancement arguments before this makes any difference, before it takes them in the guidelines grid out of the mandatory life zone?
That is correct, Your Honor. In a broad sense, Mr. Chapman complains that 8 errors committed by the trial court served to deprive him of a fair and transparent hearing. When individually viewed, these errors are not particularly shocking to the senses. However, when viewed in the aggregate, they demonstrate the laxity with which the trial court approached Mr. Chapman's sentencing hearing and call into question the proceedings' basic fairness. As such, I ask this court to vacate Mr. Chapman's sentence and remand to the Southern District of Illinois for an entirely new sentencing hearing. Each of Mr. Chapman's claimed errors are important to his overall argument, and they are fully addressed in our brief. However, I will only address 2 of those arguments today, the Rule 32 violation and the misapplication of the weapons possession enhancement. The Rule 32 violation cries out very loudly for remand. Federal rule.
This is the one where the government says, although at the trial level there were complaints about the underlying problems, there was at least forfeiture, if not waiver, of the failure to make the specific finding.
Yes, the Rule 32 issue, the underlying question, the objection that was raised by Mr. Chapman, was whether the kilogram of powder cocaine with which he was apprehended should be counted entirely as crack cocaine, or as Mr. Chapman argued, a mixture, using the mixture calculation provided for in the sentencing guidelines.
Well, wasn't the big issue whether the district court made a mistake by crediting the testimony that, in fact, when all was said and done, despite what their earlier plans may have been, Mr. Chapman and Mr. Moore had decided they were going to cook the whole thing up into crack. Maybe it was going to be 50-50 before, but now it was all going to be crack. There was also testimony on both sides of that issue, so how can we disagree with the district court?
On that issue, which is the underlying issue,
right,
pertaining to the Rule 32.
Which is firmly preserved. That was easily before the district court, held a fairly long part of the proceeding on that.
Well, Mr. Chapman argues here that the inconsistent testimony of one individual under the McIntyre case is insufficient for a drug quantity finding. Here we had the trial testimony, not the sentencing testimony, of a co-conspirator, Mr. Jermaine Barnett, who testified on page 93 of the second trial transcript that Mr. Chapman in fact intended to cook the entire kilogram into crack cocaine. That was on direct examination. 2 pages later on the transcript, on direct examination, Mr. Barnett directly contradicted himself, stating that Mr. Chapman did in fact intend to give Anthony Moore, who paid $10,000 for half of that kilogram, his kilogram in powder. Counsel for Mr. Chapman brought this contradiction in testimony to the forefront 2 pages later in the transcript at cross-examination.
What's your comment about this huge chart that goes from pages 7 to 9 in the government's brief about all the evidence of amounts that was in the record, that some of which, you know, was counted in the PSR, some of which was not, but that taken in the aggregate gets us cracked up to the 5-kilo level?
That is a substantial amount of crack cocaine that that chart attributes to Mr. Chapman. However, I claim that is irrelevant. The sentencing judge, in his findings, expressly stated that he was relying on the testimony at trial for the drug quantity, which was 1,538, inclusive of the entire kilogram of powder as crack. So I cannot disagree, Your Honor, that there are substantial amounts of crack cocaine, but the court simply did not rely on those.
Well, is it, I mean, there are two possibilities, two ways we could go from there. One of them is to say that whatever mistake the court may have made about the particular kilo, whether it was going to be half crack or all crack, and maybe that was harmless error in the light of all the rest of this evidence in the record, or you could say, because the district court didn't specifically mention reliance on any of the rest of this, we don't know how reliable he thought that was, and therefore we just don't have enough evidence to go on. I mean, but certainly a harmless error argument occurs to me when you look at this chart. Why should we not say that?
Well, arguments for harmless error can be made in many instances looking at these individual errors, but I think when you examine this proceeding in its entirety, you see, as I mentioned, a lax approach taken by the court toward this proceeding that contaminates the entire proceeding. With regard to the weapons possession enhancement, Mr. Chapman argues here that the application of this enhancement was improper based on two grounds. The court grounded the application based on, first, testimony by an Ashanti Watkins, who was Mr. Chapman's girlfriend, about non-relevant conduct. Specifically, she testified that she had seen him carry a pistol on numerous occasions during their social outings in Kansas City. Mr. Chapman here argues that this was not relevant conduct. It had no connection at all with the conspiracy to distribute crack cocaine in Mount Vernon, Illinois. It was not part of the same course of conduct or series of events. Quite simply, it wasn't relevant conduct, and the court erred by basing this enhancement on her testimony.
But didn't she say that he, quote, always had the gun, and the period of time she's talking about encompasses these drug activities? So why can't the district court think that always really does mean always, not just at the movies or when they're out in social engagements, but while he's dealing drugs? Maybe I'm wrong about her testimony, but I thought she was quite sweeping about it.
She was sweeping in her comments, Your Honor, but she also contradicted herself at other times by making statements during her testimony that indicated it was not, in fact, always. She indicated there were times that at the store, I believe, where he might not possess the weapon.
Okay.
The second basis for objecting to this weapons possession enhancement is the fact that the hearsay testimony upon which this enhancement was based was rendered truly incredible and unreliable in face of the fact that no weapons were found in the possession of Mr. Chapman nor his co-conspirators on the night that they did the big deal. Now, Mr. Chapman recognizes that possession at the time of arrest is not required for application of the enhancement. Nonetheless, he argues that because the lack of weapons on the night that he was doing a huge deal that covered 675 miles, $20,000 in cash, 1 kilogram of cocaine, 3 states, and 8 different players, the fact that he did not have a weapon on that night indicates that in Mr. Chapman's world, he didn't need a pistol to protect himself.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Clark?
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Clark and I represent the United States. First of all, Your Honors, I'd like to begin my argument with an apology. In my statement of facts, I indicated on the first page there that Mr. Moore had intended to pay, I believe, $10,000 for crack cocaine. In reality, it was the testimony at trial was that he intended to pay $10,000 for powdered cocaine. I apologize for the error. Nevertheless, I believe the testimony is clear from two witnesses, Barnett and Bowling, at trial, that although Mr. Moore's initial intention had been to purchase powdered cocaine, and apparently remained so throughout the course of conduct here, nevertheless, the plans among the three people who went to Kansas City, the four people who went to Kansas City, changed, and so the remaining group of people at Chapman's with Chapman's leadership actually intended to cook the powder into crack cocaine. I believe the trial judge was certainly entitled to rely on this testimony. It was not only the testimony of one of the co-conspirators, but of two, so they corroborate each other on that score. That was the the amount of powder cocaine that was used was 988 grams, and the judge found that the defendant intended to convert that into crack cocaine, and that serves as the primary basis for the finding of the amount of cocaine here. But then in addition to that, there was also the testimony on the other proper statements, as Judge Wood, you noted, the government went to great lengths to point out to the court the sizable amount of crack cocaine that was involved here.
But the only problem with that is, however unstructured sentencing hearings may be, there is a fundamental requirement that a sentence be based on reliable evidence. We know what evidence the district court chose to rely on. We don't know about all of these other things that you mentioned in your brief, whether the district court was of the opinion that these were reliable estimates or they were not reliable estimates. There's just no record on that. So I am reluctant myself to look at things that the only thing I know is that I know nothing about the district court's view of that. And as for the things on which the district court did rely, we don't even know simple things. I assume the district court was assuming a one-to-one correspondence between the amount of powder cocaine and the amount of crack it would be transformed into. That's not an uncommon assumption, but as Mr. Burke has pointed out, we have little guidance from the district court in terms of how these calculations were all made and whether he thinks that they were trying to cheat Moore, or whether he thinks that Moore changed his mind and wanted crack, or, you know, there are just all these questions floating around.
Actually, Your Honor, with respect to each of those statements that was introduced as an exhibit at sentencing, each of the proper statements, there was an objection by defense counsel as to hearsay. but the judge overruled each of the objections, and then he specifically later on indicated that he found that there was no question that the amount of crack cocaine exceeded 1.5 kilos here, and he said that he based that on the testimony at trial as well as proffer statements. He also says that he relied on the PSR, which of course is was overly generous to the defendant based on the other proffer statements here. But nevertheless, the court did explicitly say that it did rely on both the trial testimony as well as the proffer statements. I believe that's plural, so it doesn't just include Jones' statement, it includes all of them. And I think that if you look at all of them together, it certainly points to a large-scale distribution by the defendant in this case. So I think that I think you can find that the court properly found the right amount of drugs here. With respect to the other argument the defendant raised here regarding the weapons possession, Ashanti Watkins was the defendant's girlfriend, and certainly was in a position to know that the defendant carried a gun, as she said, at all times. Of course, there are many reasons why he might not have been in possession of a gun at the time of his arrest, but nevertheless, what her testimony does is to corroborate the trial testimony of Barnett, who indicates that during the course of the conspiracy, Barnett did witness the defendant in possession of a firearm at the time the defendant was cooking up some crack. And in addition to that, there was Caleb Watson's proffer, which also indicated that he had observed the defendant with a gun at the same time he was trying to, at the same time Watson was trying to buy some dope. The situation there was that Mr. Watson saw the defendant in possession of a firearm right near a large, briefcase full of money. I think that when you look at all three statements statements, you can easily conclude that he did possess a firearm during the course of this conspiracy, and therefore the enhancement is appropriate. Ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Mr. Burke, your time has expired, but you may have a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
The entire record here reflects that the trial court ran a loose ship that was chock full of deficiencies and errors. When viewed on the whole, the record shows that the proceeding fundamentally was not fair. And accordingly, I respectfully request this court to vacate Delbert Chapman's life sentence and remand this case back to the Southern District of Illinois for an entirely new sentencing proceeding. Thank you.
All right, thanks to both counsel, and Mr. Burke, to you and to your firm, a special thanks for you so ably representing the defendant in this case.
You're welcome, Your Honor. It was my pleasure.
All right, the case is taken under advisement.